things that people make.
Hello, you are listening to These Things That People Make, broadcasting on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph and elsewhere on the National Campus Radio Association Program Exchange and hosted on Radio for All, as well as the These Things That People Make blog, which is thesethingsthatpeoplemake.blogspot.com. My name is Sarah. I am the host, and I am so excited to bring to you an interview with Jamie Q. Today, Jamie Q is a fantastic person who I have had the pleasure of knowing since we both lived in Montreal. Probably, you know, we've known each other for at least 5 years. And recently, Jamie Q made a really cute book called What Makes an Object Queer. It is an 8-color screen printed book. And we talked over the phone about the book project. If you want to see her work while we're talking about it or afterwards, you can go to jamieq.net, and that's spelled JAMIEQ.net. And so the first thing that I had Jamie do, which is something I love to do here at These Things That People Make, is I had her describe the book and read it for us. So that's what we're going to start with.
The book is like a little pocket-sized book, and on the cover of it is the question, what makes an object queer? And the pages of the book sort of propose possible answers to that question. So the first page says something that isn't one thing or another, and there's an illustration of this object that is a mix between a cheese grater and a teapot, and it says something in between. The next page says something that doesn't do what it is supposed to do. It has a picture of a broken hammer, which is a direct reference to Sarah Ahmed's queer phenomenology. There's one part where she talks about an object that doesn't extend the body in the way that it's supposed to, like a hammer that's too heavy to hammer. The next page says something produced in a non-normative way or for non-normative purposes. It has some feet kind of making this little red polka-dotted randomly shaped object that isn't really anything. And then the page that says non-normative purposes has a picture of a red dildo. Another possible answer to what makes an object queer is something confusing or never seen before. And never seen before has in brackets might be scary for some people. And the illustrations on these pages are just abstract kind of drawings that one sort of looks like a machine that has a bubble coming out of the top and little, like, flat shapes sort of on the sides of this dome thing, and the picture of never seen before, possibly scary, has a kind of blob with, like, speckles and some scary-looking eyes in the middle. And the next pages say something that moves in a different direction, and it has a bunch of blue circles going one way and then one solitary white circle going the other way. The next page says something that tends toward other queer things, and those pages have again, like, kind of abstract objects. There's one dildo-y looking thing and some sort of look like creatures. You can't really tell what they are, but there's one that looks similar to them, kind of going towards them. And then the last page says something that leads to more questions than answers. And the illustration is another sort of ambiguous object, which is actually an illustration of an object that I have that I don't know what it is. I was going to just describe the back.
Yes, please.
A queer thing printed by Jamie Q at Sparkbox Studio, inspired by Sarah Ahmed's queer phenomenology.
Awesome.
There's a limit to your love. Like a waterfall in slow motion, like a map with no ocean. There's a limit to your love. Your love, your love, your love. There's a limit to your care. So carelessly there. Is it truth or dare? There's a limit to your care. There's a limit to your love. Like a waterfall in slow motion, like a map with no ocean. There's a limit to your love. Your love, your love, your love. There's a limit to your care. So carelessly there.
Hello, you are listening to These Things That People Make, and you just heard James Blake singing Feist cover Limit to Your Love off his self-titled album that just came out. I'm really pumped about it. I am airing an interview right now with the rad artist and great person, Jamie Q, who is based out of London, Ontario. And we are talking about her book/zine project that was recently released called What Makes an Object Queer. And she just finished reading it to us and describing it over the air. And now we are going to go back to that interview. Can you talk a bit more about what inspired you to want to make a book about queer objects?
Yeah. Well, I do all kinds of art, and I have done a lot of sculpture, and have been making mostly sculpture for the past few years. Maybe second up is like printmaking. So all these sculptures that I've been making, for the most part, have been like abstract blobs. And it's funny, when you're making something that's abstract, when you talk about it, it just becomes framed by what you say about it, or like what kind of questions you're asking yourself about it, because it doesn't really say anything in and of itself. And I just finished the master's program at the University of Western Ontario, and I spent a lot of time talking about value in relation to these objects while I was there.
What kind of value?
Financial.
Okay.
In some ways. But also, like, cultural value. Like, why are some things seen to be, like, maybe better art than other things?
What do you see people think makes better art than other things?
Well, I don't know. I don't want to say anything I'm going to regret. But I guess I kind of went into the program with this feeling like, I don't want my work to become overly academicized. Like, I don't want my work to be something that you need to read a whole, like, explanation about in order to understand what's going on mm-hmm. in it. And I ended up writing this thesis that was kind of like an antithesis thesis.
Yeah.
It's okay to make work that isn't backed up by theory, because it can sometimes have other social uses, or like create communities that don't necessarily operate like in the world of museums or in the world of academia. So there's like that value on one side.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, by the time I was done there, it was like, the more you think about it and the more you try to explain it, the more all of those boundaries kind of disappear.
Yeah.
But it's funny because after I finished there, I started making work that does have to do with theory. theory.
Yeah. And so then you decided to make this book?
Yep. Yeah, I had been reading queer phenomenology, and I was also thinking about these objects I was making. I was kind of wondering about if they could be queer objects, because mm-hmm. queer theory and queer communities have been a part of my life for a while, and it was sort of this question I was asking myself for probably about a year or something, like, are these abstract things queer things? And if they are, like, I just wanted to, like, kind of break that apart a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you come to any conclusions?
Yeah, like, I think the book, the pages in the book are the conclusions that I came to about it.
It's neat being read, too, because I looked at them and this didn't occur to me, but then when you're reading it, I was like, wow, I feel like when you're reading it to me, then those objects became metaphors for people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted it to work on that level, too, as well as being just about objects. So when I was coming up with these possible answers of, like, well, does that work when you're talking about objects? How does that work about talking about queer identity for a person? So, like, the first page was the first image that I kind of had in my mind and built the book around in some ways, mm-hmm. the one that's a mix between this cheese grater and a teapot, and it isn't one thing or the other. And I was totally thinking about gender. It was, like, male, female, like, it isn't really one thing or the other, kind of ambiguous, and, like, why do we feel the need to kind of define things in terms of these binary systems
mm-hmm.
when there's, like, a whole spectrum?
Yeah, and because you're talking about objects, it does this other thing. I don't know. Like, it invites humor in this way.
Yeah.
And it does something, like, pretty... I don't know. Like, I feel like if for whatever reason, in talking about objects, we're more able to talk about bodies or more able to see the, like, I was just like, oh, I'm feeling a pattern in the way that, like, I talk about bodies or understand bodies in my own brain from hearing you talk about objects. Mm-hmm. If that makes any sense.
Yeah. I wonder if it's because we don't really have assumptions about objects in the same way that we do about people and identities and gender, because those are so ingrained in, like, our social structure.
Yeah.
That, like, you don't really talk about objects in that way, so maybe it's more open, like, more, it's more like a...
Well, now I'm thinking that, like, most objects must be queer.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, well, I wonder if there's a difference between, like, mass-produced things and, like, a handmade thing.
Yeah. Whoa.
One night to be confused, one night to speed up truth. We had a promise made, four hands and then away. Both under influence, we had divine scent. Don't know what to say, mind is a razor blade. Two copper hands up above to lean on wouldn't be good enough for me, no.
You are listening to These Things That People Make, and we are airing an interview today with Jamie Q, who wrote the zine/book called What Makes an Object Queer? It's an 8-color screen-printed book, and I also just played a song by Jamil covering the Knife song Heartbeats, and we're going to go right back to that interview with Jamie now. We're going to pick up where we left off, where we were discussing whether or not all objects could be queer, or if handmade objects were more or less likely to be queer than mass-produced ones.
I also was thinking about, like, when I was in University at Concordia, I took a queer theory class, and the teacher was like, let's think about queer as an action or a verb. Let's think about the concept of, like, queering the system or queering ideas. And I got what she was saying, and at the same time, like, because we were in a class and we had to hand things in, I felt very cynical. I was like, yeah, whatever, okay. And I don't know, like, if you want to comment on ideas of, like, queering objects or queering the system, or like, how what you think about, like, queering things or not. Or
well, I guess my understanding of it, like, I've never taken any queer theory classes or anything, so I'm only kind of speaking from my own experience and the things that I've read.
Mm-hmm.
But based on, like, Sarah Ahmed's book, I've come to understand queering things as directional in a way, like thinking about it in terms of space. So if something is going in a straight line, it's going from, like, point A to point B. But if something is moving in a queer direction, it's not following that kind of predetermined path of, like, A to B is the point. And if you're not going towards the point, like, what are you doing? Or, like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. That makes me feel better about my own life direction.
Yeah. Yeah, like, there isn't just one direction. There's, like, multiple directions. Yeah. So that's one of the answers in my book, is, like, something that moves in a different direction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the other thing I was thinking about was, like, I was like, well, I don't necessarily think about right now in my life objects being queer, although I think there's probably a few things that I think about. But I do think about queer style, and I think about appropriation of queer style or queer culture. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know if you had been thinking about those things or what you had been thinking. If those, like, because I was like, well, you know, I wear a lot of neon colors these days, and part of that is because I just really like neon, but I also feel like it's because I'm excited about the, like, gay aesthetic of bright colors when they're not the rainbow.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've thought about that a little bit, but I don't think I've really come to any conclusions.
Yeah.
But I can sort of see a link to some of the stuff that I was working through in my thesis, which kind of had to deal with, like, outside versus inside.
Mm.
Like, I kind of came to it with this idea of, like, making work that's outside, and then the academia and the museum and that kind of thing being inside.
Mm.
And how do you kind of keep the integrity of the outside, but, you know, if you do that long enough, eventually you end up being accepted by the academy or the museum.
Mm-hmm.
And those things sort of just fall apart. It's like, well, what does it really mean to be outside or inside? And by the end of it, I'd kind of come to the realization that there isn't really an outside. Like, everybody just kind of does what they do, and it's all part of it. And the real questions are more like, well, what kind of institution are we?
Mm.
Like, what kind of values do we have? What kind of work do we acknowledge, or that sort of thing?
Yeah.
So, in terms of appropriation, like, I don't know, it's sort of like, well, if queers make neon popular again, and then everyone realizes, like, yeah, neon is awesome and starts doing it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I've been having this, the debate has died down recently, but there was kind of, you know, a tense debate around Diamond Rings, the music performer.
Hmm.
And he was playing sort of like queer bills, or he played Toronto Pride in a kind of headlining spot. And there were some queer friends of mine who were like, he's doing a really great thing because he's presenting a femininity and sort of like femi boy culture in this great way, and who cares who he sleeps with? And then there are these other people who were like, we care who he sleeps with.
Yeah.
Because he's on the stage as the headliner, and who he sleeps with affects how we feel about whether or not we want him to be headlining. So it was just interesting. Mm. It was an interesting debate. And also, it's just like, does it matter when something is so public and represents something, what their private life is?
Yeah.
Or how do we figure out if his behavior is benefiting queer people or not? Or
yeah, I have similar questions around, like, what I've been thinking about lately, and that sort of come up with the book, because I think some of the answers in the book are, they leave queerness open to being about more than just, you know, what your partner or partners have in their pants.
Yeah, totally.
It's like queerness has so many other layers to it, and it's like, who's monitoring my private, like, sexual practice?
Yeah.
Like, is that the most important thing? And it's definitely part of it, but I don't know if you can separate it from the other parts of it.
Yeah, and it's funny because just the way you said in your pants, like, it just, like, it was just like, what objects are in your pants? What do those objects need to look like in order to be queer? Yeah.
And, like, whose pants do they have to be next to in order to still be queer?
Yeah. And what do the pants have to look like?
Yeah. Yeah. Do the pants have, like, a neon belt?
How neon is it? How neon is something before it's not neon anymore? Yeah.
Was it neon before other people started wearing neon?
I think that it's interesting because now, like, then the word queer becomes kind of more exciting, and then if we think about, like, lifestyle, or we think about, like, gay gentrification, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Gay people building condos that push out people who live in poverty of particular neighborhoods, which is something that's happening a lot in Toronto where I live. Mm-hmm. And if we take your definitions in your book, like, it's just like, it's like, well, if we think queer is something good and queer is something that, like, doesn't conform and is a teapot and a cheese grater, then queer is not the condos kicking people out in this way. I don't know if that makes any sense, but
yeah, I think it makes sense.
It's cool. Can you talk, tell me the story of, like, you had a zine launch, right?
Yeah.
How that went, or how the book has been received, or?
The launch was pretty good. It was kind of like a rainy, snowy storm happening at the same time.
Whoa.
So, and also, the Beehive Collective was in town on the same night, so
divided. People had to choose.
Yeah, could have been a little bit better, but everyone who came was super awesome, and I've had tons of good responses to the book. And it's funny because it seems like people who I would think of as, like, totally living a straight lifestyle and identifying as straight are just, like, they're almost even more interested in it. They're,
wow.
Yeah, it seems like it doesn't really alienate people from, because sometimes if something is so, like, radically queer and in your face, people who, like, don't identify with that culture are just, like, they just, like, shut down from it. They're like,
totally.
I don't relate to this in any way. Like, I don't get it.
Yeah.
But it seems like people are really interested in this and can relate to it on, like, a whole bunch of different levels.
That's really exciting.
Yeah, like, it's hard to tell when people are looking at it. It's hard to tell if they even are thinking about queerness as sexuality when they're looking at it. And then they always kind of, like, laugh a little bit when they see the non-normative purposes.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder what it is about it that is more welcoming to people, but that's really exciting.
Yeah, maybe it's that people might not necessarily relate personally to having like a queer sexuality, but they might be able to understand the idea of it when it's talked about in a different way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe it makes it less scary to be like, it's okay if it's confusing. It's just different.
Yeah. I'm just trying to figure it out because like you, that book really nails it. Like nails a certain kind of understanding of like nails at least my understanding of how me and people I know define queerness. And I'm like, how did she do that? You know, like
it's
I'm just like,
because I was trying to define it in terms of my sculptures, which are just like these random paper mache blobs.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, like, some of the answers were kind of surprising to me, too.
Hmm.
Like, it just kind of happened through the process of being like, what are these objects? Like, what's a way of talking about these objects? How does it relate to this other aspect of my identity?
So you have been listening to an interview with Jamie Q on These Things That People Make. Please visit Jamie Q's blog at jamieq.net and check out all the awesome stuff that is there. There's a limited amount of books of copies of What Makes an Object Queer that are left. So if you want one, make sure that you order one soon. You can order one right off the website. And Jamie also has two zine calls for submissions that I'm really pumped about and I'm going to feature on next week's show. So be sure to tune in and listen to that. If you want to get in contact with me, you can email me at sarah.mangle@gmail.com. And as always, please check out my blog, thesethingsthatpeoplemake.blogspot.com, because it's awesome and I now update it all the time. So I hope to talk to you next week and have a fantastic week. I hope the spring comes and the snow all goes away and everything is chirpy and sunny and amazing.
Chew this up. CFRU 93.3 FM, your local community radio in Guelph.
Yeah, well, I don't know, this is Tasha T, and you don't know anytime I'm in Guelph, I always tune into Nikki Dread and the Crooked Beat, on you mean, man, on CFRU 93.3 FM, every Thursday, from 7 to 9 p.m., you don't know, we're gonna rectify the problem, let's live and learn to solve them, we're gonna make it work together for the cheese.